The news department of the National Broadcasting Company presents Eisenhower Abroad, the fourth in a series of special reports on the president's 11-nation tour. Your narrator is Merrill Muller of NBC News.
Here are four words. Mightier than any arms or bombs, mightier than machines or money, mightier than any empire. Four words that can lift the souls of men. Freedom, food, family, friendship. The speaker is the Honorable Dwight David Eisenhower, President of the United States. The place is the world's first international agricultural fair in New Delhi, India. The time was today. With that theme at the opening of the impressive American exhibition in the fairgrounds, Mr. Eisenhower assumed a share of all lonely India's crying needs without infringing its vaunted neutrality. With those words, as Prime Minister Nehru said, Mr. Eisenhower won the hearts of India's millions and just about destroyed the hopes of India's Communist Party. It is already trying to build up the visit of Russian President Voroshilov next month to recapture the state legislature of Kerala. Today it lost. Moreover, Prime Minister Nehru revealed tonight, Mr. Eisenhower is following up his pledges of friendship in freedom with solid, constructive, and private consultations on India's problems. In the cheering millions that almost worship him as the reincarnation of a god of good fortune, Mr. Eisenhower can see among the Indians their great physical hunger and poverty. He can feel in their acclaim the Indians' equally great desire to trust implicitly in a friend who respects them. Here it is easy for the president to outline publicly the ties of friendship and economic aid which America has extended and will extend to India to overcome its famine and restore hope in the eyes of its families. But on the point of freedom, Mr. Eisenhower must speak publicly within the sharper confines of India's neutrality. The slightest suspicion that the United States would like to have India in its Western military alliances would destroy everything. It's on this tightrope that Prime Minister Nehru becomes the star performer. For the Indian leader is, morsel by morsel, informing his own people and the world that the United States is ready to help India if her freedom is attacked, even though no military alliance exists. This is freedom in friendship, and Nehru underscored it tonight when he revealed the president and himself had already consulted yesterday, and would probably do so again, about Red China's demands for some 8,000 square miles of ill-defined territory along India's northern borders. Nehru hastily added that their first discussion had been without specific details. Yet Nehru also pointed out that he will have a 5-hour meeting with Mr. Eisenhower privately on Sunday, and the subject of Kashmir could come up. Nehru knows he will have to raise it. He also knows Mr. Eisenhower carries a message from President Ayub Khan of Pakistan proposing a prompt settlement of the Kashmir dispute so that both can turn their full attention to the Red China border. That northern border is a treacherous and tricky situation, yet Nehru has stated India can handle it alone. To get a look at his problem, we join an NBC correspondent who has just explored the border.
This is Russell Brown, NBC News, New Delhi. Bigger trouble is brewing on the Himalayan frontier between neutral India and aggressive Red China. Everywhere there's an uneasy feeling that the Chinese Communist border attacks are going to continue. I just made a tour of this jagged, rugged country, the roof of the world, where mountain peaks rise from 12 to 28,000 feet. It's a land of incredible beauty and majesty. A dozen different tribes of people live in poverty, filth, and up to recently in contentment. Now they are shocked to find themselves smack up against the hot front in the Cold War. All around them, these Nepalis, Sikhamis, Lepchas, Bhutias, Bengals, see the victims of communism. They are the Tibetan refugees, a ragged, tough, and proud people. You can see in their swaggering walk and strong faces that they would have the remarkable endurance to make their way over these towering mountains to escape from Red Terror. But the Tibetan refugees, most of them are from the Khamba tribe, have not yet escaped the communists. The Chinese Reds are spreading rumors like mad to pit one tribe against another, to keep people on edge. In Kalimpong, a town of 15,000, there are 100 shoemakers and they are all Chinese, part of the Red Network of Troublemakers. Some people I encountered on the border said openly, what should we do if the Chinese troops come in? Should we fight them, or feed them, or just ignore them? Indian officials frankly admit that their border on Tibet is so rough and forbidding that it is virtually impossible to defend.
While Brown was on the border, Mr. Nehru granted an exclusive interview to another NBC correspondent who's been in India for several months, Wells Hangen. In it, as released to NBC Television's Journey to Understanding last night, Nehru re-emphasized he wanted to keep United States military power out of this border issue entirely. Here are his words.
Mr. Prime Minister, what is the practical significance of President Eisenhower's visit to India?
It's rather a difficult question to answer. One significance is that we are all very pleased about it. Secondly, it does inevitably bring a greater appreciation of the two countries to each other. They talk about each other, get to know each other a little more. But thirdly, we look upon President Eisenhower, the great man, of course, as the leader of a great nation, but in the present context of events, as a great worker for world peace, which appeals to us most of all. So I hope that, apart from increasing our contacts with the United States and appreciation of each other, I hope that his visit here will also help in putting another peg in favor of peace.
In that connection, what effect, if any, do you think it will have on the dispute with China, on your problems with China?
Well, directly, in a sense, well, I don't see what effect it has. Of course, it has an effect indirectly. But directly, it is not concerned with the dispute. And he's not coming here because of that dispute. He's coming here for other purposes. Naturally, when he comes, he'll want to know, and I'd like to tell him what the state of affairs is about it.
But you don't anticipate any immediate impact on the problem as the result of his visit?
I don't think not any direct or immediate impact. Such impacts are rather gradual, sort of vague.
Could you say, sir, what role you think the United States should play in Asia today, specifically in connection with the Indian-Chinese dispute?
I'm not clear what role the United States could play in regard to this particular dispute directly, because the burden of finding ways out towards solution must lie on the countries concerned. Sometimes the attempt of a third party, even a party like an important party like the United States, coming in rather might tend to confuse the issues, bring in other issues.
Thus, half of Mr. Eisenhower's message of the four mighty words has been established. Friendship in freedom is greatly appreciated without any military strings, though such readiness to help is implied. For the other two words of his mighty phrase, Mr. Eisenhower reached deeply into his own heritage of the soil to meet in typical fashion today the main purpose of his visit to India, in fact, for this whole trip into Asia. This was the busiest single day of his 19-day schedule, and in terms of major addresses, his most important. Beside him throughout the day and during this address was NBC's White House correspondent, Ray Shearer.
The president today made enough copy to fill this program and many others. He was the middle of a continuous traffic jam. He was pink and ruddy and smiling all day long. He seemed carried along, uplifted by all the excitement here. And perhaps the climax of his day came at the speeches opening up the World Agriculture Fair. Prime Minister Nehru turned to the President and said, "We have honored you, sir, because of many reasons, but above all, because you have found an echo in the hearts of our millions, and I hope and believe that your coming here will be a blessing to all." The president had begun his day early by driving first to the striking, airy new American embassy designed by Edward Stone. He went to the apartment compound behind the embassy and delivered a little off-the-cuff talk to embassy people and their families. The president caused something of a flap among the British correspondents in our flying carpet news corps by saying that peace would not be made by two or three people sitting in something that is called the summit after exchanging views that rarely agree and probably are not pertinent to the subject. In fact, the president was not so much downgrading the summit as trying to build up the morale of the embassy people. He was making the point that in the long run, their understanding, people talking to people, would do more to ensure an enduring peace. The president stepped back into his open car and drove down the spacious avenues of New Delhi through the India Gate to Old Delhi, past 17th century Red Fort, through the crowded streets to Delhi University. This was a happy procession. Hundreds of thousands had tried to catch a glimpse of the president the night he arrived. His procession had rumbled through dust and moonlight. Few had seen him. Today, in Old Delhi, they did. The streets were hung with a network of marigolds. The sidewalks were lined with thousands and thousands of Indians, their smiles guileless and affectionate, reflecting his broad smile. The president reached Delhi University, reviewed a brisk guard of honor, climbed up on the academic platform for his honorary degree, heard himself characterized in the citation as a man who, having defeated his military enemies on the battlefield, now wants to vanquish the god of war himself. The president made a high-level speech on the purposes of the university to mobilize youth for better living to construct a system of world law. At mid-afternoon, the president made his way through another Delhi traffic jam to the World Agricultural Fair and a speech about cooperating to achieve a world free from the pangs of hunger.
As a boy and young man, I grew up in the heart of the American farmland. A long-held ambition during my professional years, not always too well concealed, has been to return to the farm. And I plan to be a farmer when my present form of occupation comes to a close. I shall see here much that is new to me. Many of these things are probably improvements on what I have seen and done in the past. And I hope I am still not too old to learn. For a moment, I hope you will indulge me as I suggest some thoughts of how food can help all of us achieve better lives in a world of justice and peace. Today we have the scientific capacity to abolish from the world at least this one evil. We can eliminate the hunger that emaciates the bodies of children, that scars the souls of their present parents, that stores the passions of those who toil endlessly and earn only scraps. Men, right now, possess the knowledge and resources for a successful worldwide war against hunger, the sort of war that dignifies and exalts human beings. The exhibit, the different exhibits in this whole fair are clear proof of that statement. The call to that genuinely native war is enunciated in the theme of the American exhibit. That theme is food, family, friendship, freedom. Into these four words are compressed the daily needs, the high purposes, the deep feelings, the ageless aspirations that unite Indians and Americans under one banner, the banner of human dignity.
This is Bob Hames standing.
Here are four words that are mightier than arms and bombs, mightier than machines and money, mightier than any
Peter
empire
Irma.
That rules the past or threatens the future. Here are four words that can lift the soul to a high plane of mutual effort. Sustained effort, the most rewarding effort that can be proposed to mankind.
Everything about Mr. Eisenhower's fairgrounds appearance had a storybook quality today. He rode into the grounds in a great black lacquered carriage with Indian President Prasad, both men shielded from the warm sun by a huge umbrella of brilliant scarlet. Six brown horses, their rich coats gleaming, pranced with the carriage through a phalanx of mounted red-uniformed lancers, their silver-tipped spears flashing in the sunlight. Past the solid, traditional Soviet exhibition, the caravan hurried and passed its message from Nikita Khrushchev. Half a block short of the hurriedly erected and smaller Red Chinese exhibition, Mr. Eisenhower used solid gold scissors to cut the ribbon to America's gleaming display. Red China had refused to participate in this fair. Then, when border trouble started, she changed her mind. The United States policy from the first was to make our exhibit the fair's most outstanding, and it is. Inspired by New Delhi's buildings of great domes, Minoru Yamasaki, American son of Japanese immigrants, has designed two gracious buildings on an artistic midway that uses the dome shape for golden umbrellas over different exhibits. The whole is surrounded by fountains in wide pools of placid water. Throughout, any Indian visitor is impressed by the fact that American farmers cooperate with industry, science, and government to produce 22 times as much food as they themselves need. Here are the secrets of American farm techniques so that Indians will know whatever Americans can do, they can do too, with America ready to help. The next Indian five-year plan calls for $22 billion expenditure, much of it in agricultural improvement, for India faces mass famine in the 1960s, unless its farm problem can be licked. Mr. Eisenhower will see much starvation before he leaves India, and he revealed yesterday in his major speech to Parliament that he is well aware of all Asia's need for higher standards of living. The President stressed that true disarmament is the key to unleashing the world's energy against its economic ills. Prime Minister Nehru said today that speech was good, just what India needed. Here is the highlight in Mr. Eisenhower's voice that impressed his host.
But armaments of themselves do not cause war. Wars are caused by men. And men are influenced by a fixation on the past, the dead past, with all its abuses of power, its misuses of responsibility, all its feudal convictions that force can solve any problem. In the name of humanity, can we not join in a five-year or a 50-year plan against mistrust and misgiving and fixation on the wrongs of the past? Can we not apply ourselves to the removal or reduction of the causes of tension that exist in the world? All these are the creations of governments, cherished and nourished by governments. Peoples of the world would never feel them if they were given freedom from propaganda and pressure.
Our own two observers, Ray Shearer and Bill Henry, traveling with the President, sat in the high-benched press section under the dome of the Parliament building and deliberately sought out signs and words of Indian reaction. Here's what they found.
Bill, yesterday as the President made his big speech to the Indian Parliament here, I was struck by the similarity to one of our joint sessions. Everybody filing in and sitting down, the notables going to the front, sitting in this big dome hall. How did it strike you?
Yes, it certainly was, Ray. Of course, I was also interested in the fact that in the reading of the speech before it was delivered, so many of the American reporters felt that it was not so hot a speech. And I think most people like you and I were both quite surprised to have the reaction quite the contrary here in India. They seem to be very, very pleased with it.
They don't seem to have been able to trot out enough superlatives in the papers here today.
Of course, it seems to me, Ray, that this is due to the fact that people just don't scatter gun speeches. They aim them like a rifle. And it seems to me that the reason is that this speech was aimed directly to the Indians, was couched in the terms that they understand, and because it was aimed at them, it apparently was a very successful speech.
It was a very dignified occasion. Mr. Nehru sitting up on the platform with the President with that lone rose in his pinned to the front of his tunic, and the marvelous, the eloquent words of the Indian Vice President, Barbara Eisenhower, sitting down in front with her husband, John, and the men applauding by thumping on discs as they do here.
It was quite a fascinating affair. It was, as you say, similar to our joint sessions in Washington, and at the same time, it was quite different. I thought that the people were, the audience was quite sprightly and certainly very much interested in what was going on. But I think that the outstanding feature of the speech was that it was aimed directly towards the Indian way of thinking, and as such appears to have been extremely successful.
Mr. Eisenhower will rest at the Presidential Palace most of tomorrow. Nothing is scheduled until the government's afternoon reception for 5,000 persons in the Mogul Gardens. But a great parcel will be sent to Barbara Eisenhower, and she's likely to call upon her father-in-law to help choose saris and silverware to purchase as gifts for the family here at home. Barbara's effort to shop in the government's cooperative emporium caused a near feminine riot in Delhi today as Indian women pressed to meet her. The emporium decided it had better send a truckload of samples to the palace. Sunday, the president flies to Agra and visits its countryside as well as India's most magnificent shrine, the Taj Mahal. Monday, he turns westward again, an Asian triumph behind him. India's best wishes go with him. As Nehru said tonight, there is a change of emphasis in America's policy toward India, a change which Nehru timed as from the death of the late John Foster Dulles. It took Vice Chancellor V.K. Rao of Delhi University to put in words the change Nehru found in policy. Said Rao, "We welcome a pilgrim of peace, a crusader for world development, and a friend of the Indian people." This is Merrill Muller, NBC News, New York.
This has been Eisenhower Abroad, the fourth in a series of special reports on the President's 11-nation tour, produced for NBC News by Patrick Tracy. Your narrator has been Merrill Muller. The fifth report in this series, to be narrated by Leon Pearson, will be heard Monday, December 14th, over most of these NBC stations. This is Fred Collins speaking.
This is the NBC Radio Network.